This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. A little later in the show, we'll be talking with Representative Mark Walker about tax reform legislation. Also, Hobby Lobby founder Steve Green on the opening of the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. But first, after a very productive trip to Egypt and Jordan recently, Tony decided to share some of what happened by having one of the people that was on the delegation join him on Washington Watch Live. Dr. Michael Youssef is the pastor of the Church of the Apostles in Atlanta, but as an Egyptian-born American, he has a unique perspective on that trip. Here now is Tony Perkins.
Dr. Youssef, it was an honor to travel with you, and it's great to have you on the program.
It's one of the highlights of my trip is to get to know you a little bit better, Tony. Really appreciate you for years, admired you for years, and just delighted to get to spend a little time with you on this trip.
Well, thank you. It was same here, and it was very interesting to watch you with your knowledge of Egypt, and I have to think this was a very special trip for you.
It was indeed. You know, last April, I had met with some of the people we met, especially the religious, the Minister of Islamic Affairs and others, and I met with the Chief of Staff for 2 hours of President Sisi back then in April, and I'm just so delighted that we could meet with the man himself and really listen to his heart and see what I have watched so closely. As we were leaving, I told him that I watched all his speeches. He said, "You glutton for punishment." I said, "No, I have on my iPad a special program where I cover hours of President Sisi back then in April." And I'm just so delighted that we could meet with the man himself and really listen to his heart and see what I have watched so closely. As we were leaving, I told him that I watched all his speeches. He said, "You glutton for punishment." I said, "No, I have on my iPad a special program where I can watch every speech you gave, and every time you speak, I resonate with what you're trying to do for the country." And he really has been trying hard. He has dealt, sometimes President Trump says, you know, inherited a mess. This man truly inherited a huge mess because his predecessor brought in over 100,000 terrorists from around the world, from Hamas in Gaza, from Yemen, from Afghanistan, and he gave them all Egyptian citizenship. And he put them there in the Sinai Desert. He says, "Look, you know, basically in case the army ever turns on me, I got these guys activated." And sure enough, as soon as he was isolated by the people, he activated them. It's still going, as you know. The terrorism has not abated in Egypt. But this Sisi, President Sisi, really has a huge, huge task ahead of him, and he needs our prayers.
Dr. Youssef, we met, and you knew a lot of these. It was fascinating to see your friendships and the connections that you had, especially with the head of the Protestant Association of Pastors. Just amazing what a small world it is and how God works.
Yes.
They asked us to bring back a message to the American church regarding the window that they see in Egypt and more broadly in the Middle East. What was that message?
Well, they feel that the window it's not going to be open for very long, that this is a window of opportunity now for the gospel to be preached and for ministries to flourish, particularly in Egypt. And they repeated it. You know, you remember, there were heads of 17 different Protestant denominations, from the Wesleyans and the Nazarene and the Assemblies of God, all the Protestant churches. It's not just one, but they were all there, and they all agreed that we got a very short window to do the work of God, and we need to really take advantage of it. I know on our part here, we have a 24/7 satellite television station in Arabic going into 160 million homes. And we're trying to take advantage of this short window. We don't know what the future brings. We don't know what's around the corner, and it could be very scary if we allow it to conjure in our minds. But I know that I sense the passion, and I sense the urgency.
One of the things, this came up in every meeting, meeting with the president, meeting with other leaders, meeting with even the Muslim Islamic leadership, the Protestant leadership, and there was agreement when it came to the issue of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yep, and if you remember, because I have been with the Minister of Islamic Affairs last April, and I spent 2 hours with him, so I know his heart, and when we're going, he was going around trying to be polite because he did not know the group, and I said, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you would want the administration in the United States to declare the Muslim Brotherhood international terrorist organization. And he said yes, and because he said that to me last April. And I really believe that somehow in Europe and the United States, we are a bit in a la-la land, and it could be other factors. I don't want to kind of blame everybody, but Egypt did it. Saudi Arabia did it. The Gulf state did it. I don't understand why we in America are afraid to do it. I know CARE is very powerful, and they have their tentacles everywhere in D.C., and they have their connections there, particularly with the Democratic Party. But I don't understand, because CARE is really the Muslim Brotherhood in America.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand why we in the United States have not done that in order to support Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and standing with them. And I was giving an interview in London at the television there, and I said the same thing to Theresa May. You need to call to, but of course they're so powerful in London. In fact, most of the leadership is now in London of the Muslim Brotherhood who have escaped from Egypt. But it is time for us to give away that fear and stand with these courageous Arab Muslims who called the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist, international terrorist organization. And that's what every one of those leaders has said, yes, they would be thrilled if we do that.
And what that would do is that would then allow the voices of what are described as the more moderate Islamic voices to come to the forefront, and it will give credibility to President Sisi and his administration that is trying to craft and maintain a peaceful coexistence between the Islamic community, the Christian community, and others.
Exactly. And right now, what they do, the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, they have two satellite channels going into the Arab world and many others. And what they come and say, see, America is not even in agreement with you in declaring the Muslim Brotherhood international terrorist organization. And they're constantly harping at him that America and Europe, they are on our side. They, you know, you on the, I mean, it will go a long way to help him and the other Gulf states.
Dr. Michael Youssef, it was great having you on the program. Great to travel with you to Egypt. Thanks so much for giving us so much time today.
Pleasure, Tony. Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out more about Tony's trip to the Middle East when you visit tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues of the day. Again, that's tonyperkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with a look at tax reform legislation.
The family is at the heart of our economy. It is the greatest generator of knowledge, attitudes, skills, and habits of the individual. It is also a great generator of prosperity. The vast majority of small businesses begin as family businesses, which then go on to become the even bigger generators of wealth. But nothing threatens family economics like taxes. What Washington does to the family budget has a direct effect on the well-being of millions of moms, dads, and children. Given the importance of family economic well-being and the sluggishness of economic growth, Family Research Council proposes 6 short-term but still productive actions that federal policymakers can take to help moms and dads better provide for their children through tax reform. To learn more about our family-friendly tax proposals, visit frc.org/taxes. Again, that's frc.org/taxes.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. On Thursday, the House of Representatives passed a massive tax reform package that includes corporate and individual tax cuts. Joining Tony to talk about the legislation is North Carolina Congressman Mark Walker.
Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Always good to be with you.
Big day in the House. The Speaker was certainly excited about what took place, and this is a big step forward.
I think it is a huge step in the right direction. There's no question about it.
And, of course, this tax package had the support of the Republican Study Committee. A lot of good things in there that you and I have talked about in the past, the Johnson Amendment, which unmuzzles churches and nonprofit organizations. So there's a lot of good stuff here. From $1,000 for the child tax credit to $1,600, doubling the individual deduction. So there's some good things here.
There's no question there's some good things about it. And you even talked about really the historic reference that it's been 31 years since we've had any kind of major movement on this particular area. And, you know, we've heard a lot of Democrats on the House floor today get upset about this provision or that provision. Well, you know, I would have to ask, during the former administration, there wasn't a single conversation about reducing or lowering taxes for middle and lower income families. So it is a huge step. I don't think that you've seen the same kind of celebration that we saw with health care, because even though it was modest today, we understand there's still work to be done, not only just to get it to the president's desk, but there's some things about the bill that can be improved as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is we know from the healthcare debate that this is just the first of many steps that has to take place to get this to the president's desk. But for a moment, I just want to focus on some of the aspects of this. Then I'm going to go to the weaknesses in this bill that we're hoping are addressed in the process. But according to the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation, this bill will cut taxes on typical households by $1,182. I mean, that's significant. Raise wages by upwards of $4,000 and create nearly 1 million full-time jobs. So, I mean, this is a real boost for our economy.
Well, there's no question about it. I can tell you, we've run the numbers 2 or 3 times for North Carolina. The average tax set will be $2,300. And even our conservative estimates, you're looking at potentially 30,000 new jobs. That's about as pro-growth as you can get. I think that's huge because it's not just the individual side, but it's reducing the highest business rate in the world down to a below average and more competitive 20%. People say, well, that's corporation. Well, where do these local jobs come from in our communities? But some of these factories and some of these manufacturing places that are doing a great job. We want these companies in our country. We want them in our community, and this allows us to be much more competitive and even bringing some of those jobs back.
Now, there are some weaknesses in this bill that we're hoping will be addressed during this process, whether in the Senate or in conference. But under our current tax system, around 70% of tax filers claim the standard deduction, meaning they do not itemize, about 30% itemize. Estimates have shown that under this tax reform framework, that number would rise to 95%. So only 5% of Americans would itemize. And there are concerns that that's going to have a negative impact upon charitable contributions.
Tony, your research is spot on as usual. It is a concern. 3 weeks ago, we anticipated, we put the bill together with our team and our staff called the Universal Charitable Giving Act. And not just to be promoting the bill, but we believe that this is the solution that allows people. Listen, America is the most philanthropic country in the world. When there's a need at home and abroad, we're the first ones to answer the call. So the idea of doing anything that would create a deterrency from people giving to their local communities, their local shelters, their local churches, their local arts council, whatever it might be, a lot of this comes from hardworking, everyday Americans, even middle and lower income families, who make a sacrifice. They don't give because of the deductions, but we certainly want to do anything that would create some kind of a valley, if you would, in a business standpoint, that you would make these nonprofits who already, many of them, are barely getting by. We certainly want to wouldn't want to create any undue stress, and I think that's why it's very important. I know Senator James Lankford has championed this for me on the Senate side, is that we get this put back into the final piece of legislation.
So what is the universal deduction essentially does is that above the allowable standard deduction, they can itemize charitable contributions, which allows them to take that additional tax write-off. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. The numbers that we have on it at this point would be up to $2,100, which is one-third above the line for individuals, and up to $4,200 per couple per family, which is also a one-third above the line. We think that's crucial, and we think if by doing so, it allows us to get some of this great tax reform done, but still doesn't put any gaps in this process that anybody would be altered in an adverse way.
Well, and it also, Arthur Brooks a number of years ago wrote about this in a book, Who Really Cares? And it looks at the multiplier effect of this type of contribution. In fact, for the concern here for the Congress as they're redoing this under the constraints of reconciliation is that everything has to be offset. There has to be these pay-fors so that every reduction in revenue coming into the government has to be accounted for. But the reality is this would cost about $1.5 billion a year in terms of government revenue coming in, but it will generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $11 to $15 billion in charitable giving, which offsets the need for the government to do so many things.
See, Tony, you're exactly right. So many times we only look at it from the government perspective and we forget, and we get this mindset in D.C., how dare we have a thought process that we would give people's hardworking money back to them to be able to invest in these charities, to be invest in their communities, to be invest church groups, nonprofits, religious organizations, whatever they deem necessary. And this mindset, and I heard it on the floor mentioned several times during debate today, much of it coming from the left, that Washington should keep more of that money to be able to use it for their own. Of course, it's funny that Democrats have all of a sudden become deficit conscious in the last two or three weeks. Not to be too partisan there, but there's another aspect of this. If I still have time, I also want to talk. If we had just a second, Tony, to talk about repealing the individual mandate. That is something right. That I think is very crucial. It's in the Senate version, and I hope that we get a chance when it comes back to conference that we can really go after this, because as of to date, it is the only piece of federal legislation that requires Americans to purchase products. The Universal Charitable Giving Act and repealing the individual mandate is still two big pieces, I think, that can be included in this tax reform bill.
Yeah, that is in the Senate bill. Senator Hatch put that in earlier this week in their version, and so that actually allows about $338 billion to be allocated in these tax cuts, because that's less money the government's going to be giving in these subsidies by mandating people to have the health care. So that's huge, and it begins the. I think the dismantling of Obamacare, because it's such a key portion. But I want to go back for just a moment. We just have about a couple of minutes left. But on the Universal Charitable Giving Act, you represent a state that has one of the largest humanitarian charitable organizations, Samaritan's Purse. I've worked closely with them. They do great work. In fact, I would argue that in many cases they do much better work and more quickly than FEMA. Not to be critical of the current administration, but it's just the nature of government. And they approach it from a holistic standpoint of actually coming alongside, putting an arm around the shoulder of the people and helping them.
Right.
We need that. When you look at what we've just gone through in the last couple of months with all of these hurricanes and the storms and the fires, and what your bill simply is allows that private sector, those non-government organizations, to take up more of the slack that the government cannot do.
Tony, I've not even heard it argued from that perspective, but that is exactly spot on. It makes me think of back 6 or 7 years ago when the tornadoes ripped through more Oklahoma, and I think ABC and CBS, or NBC and CBS did a joint simulcast, and they said this, I think it was a couple of the commentators, they said, yeah, if you're waiting on the federal government, you're going to be waiting a while, but the Baptist men are already here. And the point is exactly what you're saying. Why would we do anything or create any kind of obstacle that would prevent people like Samaritan's Purse and other organizations to be those first runners into these situations, to be able to offer that kind of aid, both short-term and long-term? This is why it's important to fight for this. I hope your audience will continue to keep the pressure on the senators to make sure that this stays in there, and ultimately, when it comes back to the House, to make sure that this is included in the final tax reform bill that we send to the president's desk.
Well, we will be talking about this quite a bit over the next few weeks as we move toward that conference and final vote on the tax reform measure. Congressman Mark Walker, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your leadership on this extremely, extremely important piece of legislation.
Happy to do it, Tony. Goodbye.
You can find out more about the tax reform legislation and Representative Mark Walker when you visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, a quick reminder that your generous contributions to Family Research Council enable us to continue making these programs available, helping you stay informed on the issues that matter to you. You can donate when you visit TonyPerkins.com. When we come back, a Washington, D.C. museum you won't want to miss.
What's more dangerous than fake news? Fake science. We should be able to rely on the unbiased facts of science for some of the biggest decisions of our lives. Our health, our education, the well-being of our families. But what if the facts are being manipulated? In his new book, Fake Science, author Austin Bruce punctures the so-called facts used by the left and reveals how poorly their version of data measures up to actual science. Visit frc.org/speakers to learn more. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Yesterday was the highly anticipated opening of Washington, D.C.'s newest museum, and it was built entirely with private funds. It's the Museum of the Bible, and on Thursday, the chairman of the board of the museum, Steve Green, joined Tony to talk about it. Here's Tony Perkins.
Steve, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's a big weekend for you.
It is. It's been a big week. We've had a lot of visitors coming through as we've invited friends and supporters to come take a peek before we open to the public, and it's been thrilling to see people come by and enjoying the museum.
Now, we've talked about this before, but this vision that you had for this museum, it came about several years ago, and it's been developing, and it's kind of mushroomed into this actual facility that's been years in the making. Let our listeners know, what was the motivation behind this?
Well, our family has had a love for the Bible for that had been passed down for generations. My parents grew up in Christian homes, and they raised us up in Christian homes. Our business, if you look at our first statement of purpose, we operate our business according to biblical principles, or at least that's what we strive to do. We've never done that perfectly. And we have been blessed to be in a nation that has been built on concepts that our founders found in the Bible. The idea that all men are created equal, that came from the Bible. And so I've traveled enough overseas to have a great appreciation for the principles our founders built our nation on, and knowing that that came from the Bible. So we have been blessed as a family by the Bible in multiple ways, and are excited about inviting all people to consider what it has to say, and hopefully they would embrace the concepts it teaches for them as well.
So, Steve Green, why Washington, D.C.? Why not New York? Why not Chicago? Why Washington, D.C.?
Well, we originally were looking in Dallas and wanted to open it up to other possibilities. And when I looked at the top 10 metros, the other two that stood out to me were New York City and Washington, D.C. So we actually were looking in all three cities when we did a survey. And in this survey where we asked 1,000 people across the country about, 100 questions, some of those questions dealt with if they would attend it in Dallas or New York City, Washington, D.C., and it showed that it would be best attended here in D.C. Second was New York City. Dallas was third. So, and as we
thought about it, it really just makes sense that this is the hub of museums in our nation. This is where the museum goers go, and we would do best where the heart of museums are in our country. So we focused right here in D.C. and acquired a facility that, as you mentioned, just a few blocks from the Capitol, two blocks from the Air and Space Museum, one of the most attended museums in the country. So a great location right here in D.C.
Well, Steve, I think it was providential. I think God guided it. I think it's very significant that it's here in Washington, D.C., and I can tell that that is the case by the controversy. I mean, there are people on the left and the right that want to criticize it, which tells me it's right where it needs to be.
Yeah, a lot of people like thinking, you know, just because we're in the shadow of the Capitol, that there's a political agenda there. And of course, what we say is we want to invite all people to engage with the Bible. That means there will be no sign saying Congress not allowed. We hope Congress does come, and our president and judges, and because it's for all people. And we need to understand the founding principles and where they came from that made this country so successful. And so we hope all people will come, including Congress.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Steve Green, my guest, president of Hobby Lobby and chairman of the board of the Museum of the Bible, which opens tomorrow here in Washington, D.C. Steve, what section of the museum, if there is one, that you're most proud of?
Well, we look at the Bible in three ways. There's three primary sections: the history, the impact, and the narrative. The history just looks at, you know, the history of the Bible, archaeological evidences and manuscript and so forth. The narrative is just to basically tell the Bible's story. And then the impact is the third one, and that's probably what I would pick out as a favorite, because it really is just for a broad audience. As a visitor comes in and they see the Bible's impact, I think they will be surprised, those that don't think the Bible's impacted their life, to realize it has, whether they know it or not, because it's impacted practically every area of life. The book speaks into every area, and it has impacted every area of life. And there's a real fun ride on that one where we fly visitors through D.C., showing them where Scripture's engraved on monuments all over the city.
Well, Steve, let me say thank you to you and your family for spearheading this, and also congratulations. I'm excited for you and looking forward maybe to seeing you tonight.
Tony, I appreciate it, and we'll look forward to seeing you.
If you want to find out more about the Museum of the Bible, just head on over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. And if you find the weekend edition of Washington Watch informative and useful, we'd encourage you to tell your friends about Washington Watch. You can help us reach more people with this radio ministry by supporting our efforts and heading over to TonyPerkins.com and clicking on the donate button. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkel, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.